This is Farmer D bringing you season two of the Citizen Farmers Podcast, where we are reimagining community through interviews with citizen farmers throughout the country. This season, our goal is to inspire, teach, and connect you to the projects, people, and places that are changing the way we live through regenerative agriculture, conservation, and community development. Are you ready to build a healthier, more connected world? Let's get started. All right. I am here with Steve Nygren, founder of Serenby and legendary restaurateur. I'm so excited, Steve, to have some time to chat with you. I consider you one of my great mentors and one of the best things that happened to me, meeting you and stumbling on Serenby.
Well, thank you. And looking forward to the conversation today. And I've enjoyed following your career now since you were at Serenby.
Yeah, it's been about 15 years, I guess, since I left.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking about it. I remember very vividly the day that I found out about Serenby. I was a landscape architecture student at the University of Georgia. I think it was about 2001. And I was walking in to meet with the dean to tell him that I was going to drop out of school for the second time. And I was actually going in to ask his advice if I should drop out of school because I had this career opportunity. And I was shocked at the end of my conversation with Dean Crowley, Jack Crowley. He says, you know, first he said to me, "You should drop out of school, D. Here's a career opportunity exemption." Not what I was expecting, but it was pretty excited news. And then he said, "You know, you really need to go check out this place called Serenby." And he cleared his desk and there was this, like, you know, master plan. And he starts talking to me about transfer of development rights and hamlets and clusters, and they need a farmer, he said to me. And at the moment, I kind of looked at him like surprised he was throwing another opportunity my way when my problem was I had too many. And but, you know, serendipity led me there to Serenby. And the rest is history.
It is. It's serendipitous. And you know, I've always believed in Serenby. You know, the people we need just show up. And you were certainly an indication of that. You were the perfect person. But of course, we had not advertised. We had not done anything other than talk about the project. And so that's how it's happened and continues to happen today.
I remember you said to me, you kind of, you said something along the lines of like, "I've been waiting for you to come," like maybe heard something about me. And then you said, "Get in the truck." And you drove me through the dirt road that's now the main road through Serenby. And you started pointing in the forest, explaining all these incredible visions. And to see it evolve over the years has been really inspiring. So I'm curious, tell me a little bit about like, what was your original inspiration? Because I know you have a, you know, background in the restaurant business, right? And what was your inspiration to start Serenby?
Well, you're right, Darren. I was the hospitality guy. I started out in Atlanta in my 20s and really brought about new American cuisine. And so we had spread around the country and I was on a lot of great boards and experiencing some of the frustration that I think a lot of people are today, that how do you change a world that I thought was crazy then? And this is, you know, 25 plus years ago. And we had a weekend farm and I found, gosh, the spirit of life where we were truly happy, where we calmed down, as we said, where we found the serenity that we had been searching for out here at the farm. And, you know, we had fixed a shack in the back because we didn't think we would spend many nights out here and rented the old historic house out. But the kids who were then 3, 5, and 7 would choose to spend the whole weekend and vacations out here in the shack where we had no toys. And we had a great house in Ansley Park, an acre in Ansley Park, which is unheard of, you know, on top of the hill with the pool and all the toys, matching Barbie cars, anything money could buy. And what did they want to do? They wanted to come out here to the shack. And the family as a whole was happier. And so through frustrations on the people I'm supporting not being elected to public office, making very little change on boards, whether it's health or arts or social issues, And just everything came together that I had an opportunity to sell the company. People had talked about if I ever sold the house, let them know. I called them, they would. And so one Monday morning, after a great January weekend, sunny like it is here today, you know, one of those winter days is just beautiful. The sun's shining, the skies are blue. And that Monday morning, we were driving back into Atlanta, and there was a cloud of smog just sitting over the city. And I thought that was symbolic that I was literally driving my family back into the smog and everything that represented. And that morning, I made the decision to sell everything and step off the treadmill.
Wow.
With the intentions of just nothing more than just that. And so at that point, we started restoring the 1905 farmhouse. We put in the organic gardens, bought some farm animals. People started giving us farm animals. And my hair ended up down to my shoulders because we literally didn't go to town for things. We literally stepped off the treadmill. And we bought, we're able to put the old farm back together, not really knowing why, just why not. Our original purchase was 60 acres. And by my seventh year of retirement in 99, we had 300 acres. And one morning, my daughter and I were jogging along what was then our property line, and a bulldozer was bulldozing the forest next to us. Mm. And I ran out and stopped the guy and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "We've just been hired to clear the trees. I guess they're putting houses here. That's what always happens." And that was my moment of panic. And I didn't realize it, but it was that moment that I stepped out of retirement and recreated myself as a developer.
Wow.
Purely to deal with saving my own backyard.
That is amazing. And, you know, it resonates so much with me and having a 3, 7, and 8-year-old right now, looking to get away from our smog, which was the fires in California. And also the smog's only gotten worse, right, in a lot of places. And I left out one thing when I first, you know, when I first met you and we started chatting and you said, "Hey, you know, want to come start this farm?" I called my uncle because I knew you were, you know, a big wig in the restaurant world. And I don't know if I ever told you this, but my uncle Selwyn lives in LA and he was Wolfgang Puck's right-hand man when they opened.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I called him. I said, "Hey, Sel, do you know this guy, Steve Nygren?" And he laughed and he said, "Of course I know Steve Nygren." He's like, "Anyone in the, you know, you're very humble in your background. I just want to share this," that he was like, "Anyone in the restaurant industry knows Steve Nygren. He's considered the maverick of what we know of today as kind of this, I'd say what we know of today as farm to table dining, right? Like what became the kind of boutique restaurant and the culture of restaurants." He kind of credited you as one of the real pioneers. And so he said, "Well, why are you asking?" And I said, "Well, I've got an opportunity, you know, to potentially go work with him on this project." And he says, "I don't care if you're changing the guy's sheets. You should go work with Steve Nygren."
You never told me that, for gosh sakes.
Yeah. So I said, "Oh, okay. Well, that was a pretty serious testimonial." So now you went from a restaurateur to a retired dad to a developer trying to save the forest and save the rural character of where you found happiness.
You know, as you are, Darren, I think we have that disease that we just, when we see something that needs done, we just can't quite sit still. and it just doesn't seem as complicated. And it's just curious and baffling why we go on in such a dysfunctional way in so many parts of our industry. Farming is certainly one of those huge areas. Development is one of those areas. It's incredible.
And this is what's so interesting, you know, about Serenby. And, you know, I've worked on so many projects since leaving there, and I still go back to point at Serenby as really kind of the most important project from the perspective of conservation. You know, so many projects now have gotten this kind of like, you know, the farm is the trendy new amenity. People, you know, always talk about they want to create kind of a Serenby-like project. I mean, you've really built kind of a brand and an identity for a movement with what you've done there. And, you know, this idea of kind of conserving open space and redesigning community and agriculture to work in harmony with each other sounds like in part for your inspiration was trying to solve the ways that things are not being done well in a few of these industries. But also, I know you talked about being inspired by your trips to Italy too. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, in my 7 years of retirement, we love to travel all the time. So in the 7 years of retirement, we took every opportunity when the kids were out of school, and we would travel to Europe a lot. It's just a different culture. And I started out in architecture at the University of Colorado, and before I was seduced by the hospitality industry. So I was just observing, taking in just from points of interest, never thinking that I was going to use this. And of course, through developing all my restaurants in the various cities, I was certainly in another arm of development and architecture there. So it wasn't like it was something that had been foreign or that I didn't touch. And so it was just the observation. And so when I realized that we were actually going to end up developing, all of that information, contacts, it all came flooding in as though, this is the reason I've done all these things. This is the reason I know these people. This is, you know, it's at 1 to 2 degree separation. You know, Jack Crowley had come down here to see us. And then sure enough, you show up in his office. It's those kinds of things. It felt like
relationships.
Yeah. You know, Ray Anderson, who's the big environmentalist, had been a dear friend of ours from years. And in fact, his stepson's godfather, Dar Quinn, our youngest, who's now, 32?
Wow.
So when I was in the midst of this concern and buying more property just to protect our backyard, which was my first step, it wasn't immediately to develop. It was, how do I buy something? So after 600 acres under contract, I realized I couldn't keep doing that, and that really didn't protect me. And so at dinner one night, I said to Ray, you know all the smart people in the environmental movement. And for your listeners that don't know that name, Ray had Interface Carpet and was the first U.S. industrialist to put his company on an environmental path. And when the White House created the Council on the Environment in the 90s, he was the first chair.
Yeah, I mean, he's really kind of like you in your arena, the real pioneer, along with, like I'd say, Paul Hawken, right, in kind of the sustainable business world.
Absolutely.
I had one moment with him. I think you might have been there, where it was the Earth University gave out these awards.
Yes.
And I won an award with Ray. And when I got up to go receive the reward, Ray gave me a high five. And it was like one of those like pinnacle moments. Like, I just high-fived Ray Anderson. Like, that was awesome. Anyway.
Well, yeah. So he'd been a dear friend. And so I said, Ray, you know, who should come help me? And so he asked the Rocky Mountain Institute. And so Ray and the Rocky Mountain Institute assembled 23 thought leaders here for 2 days in September of 2000. Hmm. And so that's what really put us at the forefront of a lot of these environmental issues. I mean, there weren't that many people speaking about things that we understand today, just 20 years later. And so I really credit Ray with introducing me and then in turn pushing me into actually taking action.
And you are a man of action, because I've seen it in first person. I got the opportunity to, you know, work side by side with you for 3 years there, building the farm while you were just starting to really build the community. And a couple things that I remember well. One is that you were always really energized. I think you had like some power smoothie in the morning, and you were on the move, like never stopped. And you loved lists. I remember the lists, the handwritten lists. And I'm curious, just as for fun, like, what's on your list right now?
Well, you see, now I don't have to write anymore. I just have my phone out, and I can just take pictures, and then I make the list on Monday morning. Everybody gets the list.
It's still right. So, what are some of the big things on the list?
Well, you know, if you want to see the big things, you know, in your sweet spot, of course, it is agriculture. And what are we going to do, you know, to change the agrarian economy? You know, farm to table is nice. That's a boutique approach, but it's really that complete agrarian economy. And we're thrilled, you know, here a year ago or so, in various national organizations, because of people come to visit Serenby now. And so I sort of get to see what some of the thought leadership is thinking about. And so we invited the four national organizations, the Urban Land Institute and Rodale Institute, the National Farmland Trust, and the Conservation Fund, who were all talking, you know, in one way or another. And so we had what I called a 24-hour dinner party. Mm-hmm. Because these people, I found out, didn't know each other. They were all dealing with a piece of it, but
siloed.
Yeah, and there were so many overlaps, and it was a great time. And now here we are, a year later. Rodale Institute just 2 weeks ago cut the ribbon on their Southeast Regional Research Center, which is on my neighbor's farm. I had a cocktail party and explained what we needed to do and how much money we needed to raise, and my neighbor stepped up and said, "You can use our 300 acres." And it's just an incredible research center. So as we know, you know, how we deal with our soil and how we deal with rural America is an answer to a lot of our issues, whether it's environmental and our food systems. And just I'm passionate to move these conversations forward.
Nice.
You know, and then land preservation. You mentioned transfer development rights. It's such a common sense thing. And we are a good example on how it can link development to preservation. All of your preservation groups, God love them, they're doing hard work, but there's no way they can stay ahead of the development bulldozers. They just can't raise that kind of money fast enough. And through transfer development rights, it's just an approval process and moving density into where you allow development and you preserve the other, and it's not a dollar and cents. And it allows small landowners to participate in the development economics. And it's just such common sense. You see models of it in Boulder County, Colorado, Montgomery County, Maryland, and here in the Chattahoochee Hill Country. And I just, you know, it's one of those things we need to move forward in a lot of different ways.
You know, I remember there's a really simple diagram that you used to have on the wall. And it was basically the simple diagram of what typical development looks like, you know, especially around Atlanta, where 80% of the land gets developed into houses and roads with no commercial, no retail, just houses, 80% of the land, sprawling suburbia. And next to it, you had the same kind of shape land, right, with 80% of the land protected and the development transferred, right, into density, into a cluster, where 20% of the land had all the development, all the houses, and all the businesses. So now you have a walkable, pedestrian-oriented, not a car-dominated, suburban, sprawling landmass where all the wildlife corridors and all the agriculture goes away. But rather, you create a sense of community with a village, and everybody gets to enjoy this beautiful nature, open space, and agriculture. It was just, I remember looking at it just being like, oh my God, it's like the great duh, right? It's like, duh.
It's how we developed and how we lived 100 years ago. And this experiment we've had, especially post-World War II, I don't think it's worked out too well.
No.
And so we need to go back to this common sense stuff. And boy, times like the pandemic, that really shows, because we didn't have to change how we lived here at Serenbe because we had front porches. We, you know, everybody knew the farmers. We were not used to having to drive out to our services. Everybody could just hunker down right here and still feel connected, but not have to leave. And I think what we're seeing is this is going to change the real estate sense in, you know, people don't have to go into these big office centers necessarily, and how important community and where you live is.
Yeah, and Serenbe has been such an interesting, you know, success story in that you were so innovative and trying something different, especially in the South. And then you weathered the 2008 downturn and a lot of developments. I remember, you know, a lot of the projects I was working on didn't make it through that downturn. You did. And then you came out, you know, kind of roaring. I think people after the 2008, I know for my business, picked up big time after that because people's values shifted and they started to see things differently. And I think now I'm curious, how has COVID changed the landscape for you at Serenbe? Are you getting a lot more interest? Do you feel like people are finally catching up and seeing the value?
Oh, we cannot sell houses fast enough. And appreciation, you know, some people, you know, that maybe didn't think about selling or suddenly selling because the appreciation's happened. Hmm. We don't have any available product. It is just crazy.
Wow.
You know, we've just opened a whole new section. We are so behind the eight ball in
meeting the demand, huh?
Meeting the demand.
So how many homes and families or people are in Serenbee today?
We're right at 350 houses, about 800 people, with somebody new moving in literally every week.
Wow. And when it's, quote, you know, finished in the current iteration, how much capacity do you have when this is built out?
Well, that's the question when you think about the we. So Serenbee owns 1,400 acres, and the master plan through development rights, we'll have somewhere between 1,600 to 1,800 housing units here. So, you know, about, you know, 3,500 people probably population. But then you think about the, we're the first development in this 40,000 acre city that has all these regulations. And we'll see some things happening there in places outside, and we might, you know, Serenbee itself might expand. So, you know, this entire area will hold 40,000 housing units, but all clustered on 30% of the land, with 70% preserved for anything that's under agricultural zoning. And that could be recreation, forestry, farming, equestrian. Right here on the edge of one of the fastest growing metropolitan areas, 25 minutes from an airport that connects you to the world. It's kind of a unique place.
I don't think a lot of people realize that about Serenbee. I know when I was there, I was sitting on the agricultural committee for the Chattahoochee Hill Country when it was first kind of getting going. And that was really interesting to me because I think, you know, you had the vision, protection-based development, where you were protecting kind of your own homestead and quality of life, so you created Serenbee. And then it seems like you realized that's not enough to really protect the rural character of this greater region that you sat in the area that you were in. So then you were one of the pioneers again at saying, well, how do we look at this at a much larger scale, and forming the Chattahoochee Hill Country Alliance, I think was what it was originally called, right?
That's right. That is.
And that was really to take the transfer of development right concept that you had applied at Serenbee to a much larger scale, which is what you're talking about. And it was successful.
That's right. It's kind of the reverse. When I realized we were going to develop, I looked at places like Seaside, where we took the kids all the time in the 80s when it was just a beach village with dunes all around them. Or Ray had introduced us to the Rainies outside Chicago with Prairie Crossing. And in all cases, I found that people that had great models really did not affect the area immediately around them. In fact, they accelerated the destruction, is what I saw as destruction of it. And so I realized that it wasn't a volunteer, that if we were really going to save this area, it had to be by policy and zoning. And that's why it took 2 years to bring 500 landowners together before we ever move forward with Serenbee, to look at the greater vision and to see where the, you know, this wasn't imposing. It was simply, I was saying to both the development community and the residents that didn't want anything to happen, what do we want the future to be? Are we going to wait for somebody else to come in and start changing this, and then we decide to think about it? Mm-hmm. And so we really inspired those conversations, and we were able to bring 500 landowners together. Well, we brought the alliance, which you mentioned. We created a due structure of $2 an acre, as much to gauge support as it was to raise the money to do some of the things we needed to do. And by the time we took that to the commission to vote on the largest land use change in recent history in Metro Atlanta, 80% of the land was paying dues into the organization.
Wow.
The 20% that didn't support us also never opposed us. They just stayed home. They didn't educate themselves, nor did they show up to any meetings to oppose it. So that was the first task that we had to do. And then we realized that to accomplish some of the things we wanted, and this brought pro-preservation and pro-development together. And, you know, we showed that we could bring a greater value if we developed in this clustered area. And, you know, Urban Land Institute had done all the studies on why we had so many golf courses. Well, 92 or 94% of the people played golf twice or less a year. So it was for the open space. And so we said, wouldn't it be as much value or more if they opened onto a farm or a forest or, you know, a pasture with animals grazing? And so we were able to get that group change. And,
amazing.
And so then, of course, Georgia, the Southeast, didn't have development rights. And so working with the University of Georgia land and law departments. They did the research, modeled it, and then the Association of County Commissioners for Georgia carried that for us in the 2003 legislative session. And so then once all that was in place, then I realized we were ready to develop Serenbee, and we broke ground here in 2004.
You know, what's so inspiring about this story you're telling me is, you know, this is the Citizen Farmers Podcast for a reason. It's about us taking action as citizens, right? And part of it is just how you spend your dollar has a big impact. And you've taken it to the level where of being a real advocate and influencing policy to make the kind of changes at scale that you've been able to do with Serenbee in the Chattahoochee Hill Country. And I think that's something that it's daunting to a lot of people to think about going in and trying to change zoning and policy and navigate the complicated world of politics. You know, having been working in this space now for 20 years, I've been in a lot of city council meetings. I've been through a lot of entitlements. I've seen what developers go through. I see the NIMBY stuff and the education that's required to move these kinds of projects forward. And I just think it's incredible. You know, especially in a place like Georgia, which, you know, I'm from there. And you know, it was always interesting to me to go back from California to Georgia to be at a progressive project, you know? And so, you know, I really applaud you for that. You know, I think it's an important part of the story, because it sounds like without that work, it would have been near impossible to do what you're doing.
You had to do that work, because otherwise we would have been just this example. And because of our success, we would have traditional development strip malls on the roads leading to Serenbee by now, which you see other places that's what's happened. And so, you know, policy is absolutely where change. And we certainly need that in the agriculture community. I, of course, come from generational farmers in Colorado and grew up on the farm. And so, you know, I've had a front row seat to see what's happened with the agricultural movement and this whole idea that we've changed and gotten big and done away with the agrarian economy. You know, big farms do not support the local banker or the implement dealer or everything that makes a small agricultural community what I remember it being. And we have to change that. You know, the two grids that I think are the most vulnerable, it's our food system and our power grid. And they both should be regional systems rather than these national or global systems. Mm-hmm. And if we think this pandemic is bad, imagine if it were a foodborne disease. And I believe the latest statistics I saw is we have allowed almost 60% of our food to be grown on foreign soil. There's just, if there's one thing we're going to see that's really going to hit the country, is when there's a problem that we cannot import that food and that whole mm-hmm. chain of supply is interrupted.
So let's dig into that a little bit more and talk about the farm at Serenbee. What was your original kind of intention or inspiration behind having the farm as part of the community?
Well, of course, growing up on a farm, I knew it was important. And once we looked at it, if I was going to develop, how are we going to develop? Well, what were we going to do? Number one was this idea that, you know, the only way we could preserve the land is if you found this balance. And so we did that through the clustering of creating a village and then the land preservation. But that was just one component. If we're going to have a place that people want to live, what's that like? And when I started talking about the environmental issues, reducing energy demand and some of the things of the day just 20 years ago, people thought I was talking about straw bale houses and, you know, these earthen houses. And especially the financial community thought, oh, you know, an overgrown hippie, you know, I've seen this stuff happening. And so I realized that this was one of the problems with the movement. It was too idealist and two ideas of the idealism of the 70s. And that's why I dropped talking about an environmental community. And realized that if I was going to change the dial on this whole subject, that we had to create a great place for people to live. So what are the pillars? And so that's where we established the four pillars of art, agriculture, education, and health and wellness, that we would build out Serenbee with those pillars. And so that's when, you know, for the agricultural point, We wanted the farms right next to the houses, you know, and while places like Prairie Crossing were starting to realize farms, they were off in a corner and they were still fenced and they weren't an amenity. There was an attitude that, you know, farms were something that people wouldn't want to live next to. And of course, our design, you know, we didn't do soil tests. We didn't choose the land, as you well know better than anyone.
Oh, man, that was a lot of work.
It was physically where we thought it should be, according to our master plan. Of course, Phil Tabb was the sacred geometrist and laid out. But, you know, the truth being, you know, there isn't in this greater area that much great soil. It was all depleted during growing cotton, and we lost all of our topsoil. Mm-hmm. And so you certainly set the place in motion that I know you scratched your head and thought this guy's nuts, but let's humor him and see what we can do, and let's amend the soils. And you know, our soils today are some of the best and high producing. Mm-hmm. So it can be done, and it doesn't take years. It just takes dedication. And by the way, Darren, you'll be happy to know that all of our composting comes from Serenbee today.
Oh, amazing.
Between, of course, a great thing is we have bamboo, which is your cold pressed juice. So they literally, I mean, tons of.
Oh, they generate a lot. Yeah.
Oh, a lot there. And then we have the horse stables. And then the community has really rolled up their sleeves, and plus the restaurants. So we're able to have a complete compost that does all the amendments for the farm now.
Oh, that's amazing. And I know you've got edible landscaping going on throughout the community. So it's not, you know, I see a lot of times one of the disconnects is, you know, you put the farm in and the rest of the project kind of is conventional. And I think it's admirable to see, you know, that you've started to integrate the ethos of the farm into the landscape, into the composting, into the culture of the place.
Well, it should be a culture. And it, you know, I'm not sure why we spend all of our money on ornamentals when we can have edible landscapes that's just as beautiful. You don't have to put the chemicals, and we're just so upside down in so many of the things we do, and that's one of them is we put turf in, and it's making us sick, and we wonder why we're depressed and have cancer. Well, we're poisoning the atmosphere we live in.
A lot of it's the way we steward or don't steward land. How is the farm? I know you know, things have evolved over the years. How is the farmland held? Who owns the actual farmland, and what's kind of the structure that you've put in place that you find is working best for the agricultural part of the project?
So it is a teaching farm, and so the actual land is still held by the development company. But the system in all of our preserved land, and the farm is part of our 70% preservation, will go to the ownership of the HOA. However, it will be managed by the Serenbee Institute. So you can't have a homeowners association come in and decide they would rather have a Frisbee course than the farm. And so it's in the documents that this land has to stay a farm, and we have this two-prong preservation piece on it. And the land will also have a conservation easement, an agricultural conservation easement on it.
And so talk to us a little bit about the Serenbee Institute. That's a nonprofit that... What happens within the institute?
That's right. So we set up an institute to look at how to fund some of these things perpetually. And so there is a 1% transfer fee for every house sold or resold. For a vacant lot is 3%. And everyone pays that except for a builder. If a builder takes down a group of lots, they do not pay it, because they're doing those to actually do the house. And so that funds the arts and environmental program. So we have not used that money to support the farms in any way, because the farm became really self-sustaining within the fourth year. And we believe all the things, the arts and all these things, to be truly sustainable, they need to be economically sustainable. So the funds for the Institute are really as a support system to get places started, you know, a 3 to 5 year lead time to establish that. And so, you know, the because of that, you know, the farm, we really, if you look back on it, we were the beginning of what people think of as agribusiness today. And that was a New York reporter doing a story. And that's what she called it. Everyone tries to put a name on something, you know. But that all came from that New York Times article.
Mm-hmm. So just a quick follow-up on that. Is there any HOA dues in Serenbee?
Yeah, there absolutely. So HOA dues support, you know, your streets. We have all natural landscaping, and so it does all your front and side yards on the smaller properties that are really clustered. If you have like 10 to 12 units to an acre, it does all the landscaping because they really don't have big private yards. And all of our trails, about 15 miles of trails. So the dues handles all those functional kinds of things. They do not carry the horse stables, the farms, the swimming center. They all have to economically stand on their own.
Interesting. So there's never been HOA dues associated to support the farm in any way?
That is correct. We looked at what developers, because I was the novice learning how to do this. So, you know, I certainly looked at what other developers were doing. And I was able to ask, you know, questions that many thought stupid or at the time. Yeah, everybody thinks I'm crazy anyhow. What could we possibly do to promote this or to make people understand? And we're going to have to do it by doing it. So in the first 3 years, how I supported, paid your salary, Darren, and supported it is I took it out of our marketing budget.
I got to say, I remember very well going to the farmers markets with the Serenbee Farms sign and beautiful produce those early years. And people were like, what is this place? And it was like such a great way to introduce somebody to the community, you know. And do you feel like it was effective from that perspective?
The farms is probably one of the greatest marketing dollars we have ever spent. And it continues. We still continue to sell more houses because we have an authentic farm with real farmers. And I put that because, you know, the one problem with this whole agri-hood movement is some people are putting pretty gardens at their front entrance. And if you don't know what you're doing, you know, that can be a real detriment to the movement as well as a project itself.
Well, and you know, that was the inspiration in part for when I was able to help fund the ULI Agri-Hood Cultivating Best Practices Initiative was largely inspired by the fact that I saw some of that greenwashing and some of those mistakes happening. And I could see where such a great idea, you know, the seed of what was planted at Serenbee and Prairie Crossing and a few of these other leading communities, but it was just getting greenwashed. And people, and a lot of it was just a lack of understanding what it really is about. And so, you know, we had the opportunity, I think you and I both participated in that food and real estate forum that ULI did with the Colorado Health Foundation.
And they have a great report that came out of that.
Yeah, that Cultivating Development report. And then, you know, I went to ULI after that and I said, hey, you know, can we really drill down into the agri-hood part of this? Because the farm is at the center of food. You know, all this other stuff is interesting, the food hubs and the markets and but like, it's about agriculture at the end of the day being really part of development. Kind of what you said around like pro-preservation and pro-development people can come together around something. Well, you know, I think pro-ag local food systems people and pro-development, when you can see that development can help not only preserve agricultural land, but help support the kind of farms that we really want to see in those agricultural lands, in those rural areas that are actually feeding people healthy, nutritious food and engaging and teaching and building community, right? Placemaking. So that was great. I really enjoyed that you came out for that at Coastal Roots and we got a chance to reconnect. And I think that gathering in those couple of years of, you know, at least helped move us a little bit closer to better understanding and communicating to the mainstream what this is really about. But we still have a lot of work to do.
Well, there's a lot of work and it has to move beyond the development community. And because it's still a volunteer, many times the financial community doesn't put the true value on it that they should, whether it's, you know, environmental or agriculture or all these things. So this has got to change. And it's got to be communities, counties, cities. And, you know, you talked about the South. We're really leading in a lot of models. And Atlanta is the first city to have an ag commissioner reporting directly to the mayor.
It's amazing. I just met the new one last week. He's awesome.
Yeah, and we're dealing with food deserts by putting farms and gardens into these places and teaching people how to grow and take care of their food. This is the kind of movement that's going to change. And looking, you know, Biden and Pete Buttigieg were the two people through all, everyone, whether Republican or Democrat, they were the only ones that talked about rural America and soil. You know, and if you look at that documentary, Kiss the Ground,
it's a great movie.
You realize how important it, you know, and if we start paying farmers, you know, and we've got to be careful how it's regulated, but for carbon, we start taking care of the soils. This is where you're talking about policy that's going to change things. Let's move the incentives as we have it in agriculture to places that's going to take care of the soil and the food and the food systems. And imagine if some funding depended on how much a county could demonstrate they were growing their own food. And, you know, you start changing that and funding starts going that, suddenly people are going to start asking questions they aren't even asking today.
Mm. It's huge. Not only does it start to really, move us in the right direction with carbon and addressing some of the issues of climate change, but it also starts to create jobs and it starts to address health. You know, I mean, a lot of these rural communities are just devastated by obesity and diabetes and poverty and, you know, hunger and homelessness, you know. So I think there are so many potential solutions that start from the way we look at soil, the way we look at agriculture.
Yeah, I'm convinced, you know, dealing with the whole agrarian system answers social, economic, political issues. We have to roll up our sleeves and get started.
Well, you've done a good job of getting some momentum. I appreciate your quasi retirement turned innovative developer ambassador for the planet. It's looking good on you and you're in this chapter of your life. And I feel really honored to be able to be a part of that in a small way and continue to cultivate the relationship. I'm curious, one thing, just going back to something you said about the farm, you know, and I think this is one, when you talk about the financial community understanding the value of it, and I'd say the development community, right, and the municipalities understanding the value of this, I'm always fascinated to see almost every general plan, master plan for these communities all say the same thing. We want to preserve the rural character, right? We want to like see local agriculture continue. How, from your perspective, I mean, how much would you say, and this is a kind of a tricky question because you've got so many amazing things at Serenbe that increase the value of that place over maybe the competitor places that people could live. But can you say, like, from your experience now, 18, 20 years in, what percentage of a premium would you say the Serenbe's getting as a result of being a conservation, agriculturally themed community over some of the others?
Well, I get this question a lot. So for your listeners that do not know the geography of Atlanta, we are southwest of Atlanta, where is low real estate value. This area hasn't developed because there wasn't infrastructure or roads or anything coming out here. So if you look at our premium for our geographic quadrant of Metro Atlanta, we're 50-60% premium.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, yeah. And we're able to, if you look at the average metropolitan, we're probably a 20% premium and compete price-wise with some of your best neighborhoods in Metro Atlanta.
Amazing. I got an interesting question for you here. From my perspective, it's interesting. I don't know if everybody else thinks so, but so Serenbe was kind of this like retirement reaction, right? It was like you were not necessarily going out there to say, I'm going to buy this property to create a village and reimagine what communities look like in the world. If you were to do this over again, where would you do it? If you were to pick where are the ideal places for future Serenbes to happen?
Well, the big thing is you have to look at critical mass. If Serenbe was a postage stamp in the middle of the best neighborhoods, you know, it wouldn't have the same effect. And we're helping, you know, developers do that, that are buying the last farm in metropolitan areas. and how are they going to develop it? So we're helping developers now do that, and that's an important piece. But it's not nearly the same as you have critical mass of, you know, 5,000 acres, let's say, that you cluster the development and it's all agrarian. But if you look at most of our urban cities, Atlanta, you do aerials, there's a lot of unused low density areas. And some of these are going to change just because our transportation systems, how we get around, it's not going to be the same 10, 20 years from now. And that's going to force changes, just like the interstate highway has changed how we lived. Once we're not driving all of our own independent huge cars to get somewhere, how we live is going to change. And I think there's going to be opportunities to come in and put farms in places we can't imagine. Atlanta's showing that in some of, you know, the low income housing where houses have burned down or been torn down and there's vacant lots. And all of a sudden you have expanding farms right in the middle of the city.
That makes so much sense, right? Because there's already critical mass, density, infrastructure. You know, you're talking about, you know, brownfield, urban retrofitting the urban environment, you know, whether it's turning old shopping malls or, you know, antiquated spaces into more relevant, you know, community health center, farm-based education, whatever they are, which I think there's a lot of exciting opportunity around. But to your point, that's kind of like bringing the country into the city, bringing kind of more healthy lifestyle experiences, more green belts, greenways, urban farms, community gardens into the inner city, public gardens, and which is really important. When you think about the future of development, you know, obviously you're going to see a lot of that. But what I'm most fascinated by these days is these kind of suburban edges, these like greenbelt peripheries where development is putting pressure, and in these rural communities that aren't very far from major cities that are kind of, you know, depressed rural towns, villages, have some infrastructure, a lot of ag around it. Do you see that as a big opportunity to really reimagine the way that the suburban landscape and rural communities could evolve, taking some notes from the Serenbe playbook?
Absolutely. We're seeing it happen, whether it's city or county planners. You know, they're coming to Serenbe to understand this and how it works, the agricultural community. And right here in Metro Atlanta, in working with Jamestown, who had property right on the river in Cobb County, we started looking, okay, what's happening to the greater area? I always ask, what's happening to the greater area? You know, and what does everybody else want? You know, and that was a mix of development from Smyrna pushing and industrial and kind of all those tensions of different uses. And yet here it was on the river that my God, you know, one of our great resources, were we just going to start doing the same things that we've done for the last 50 years along the river? And that led to forming Chattahoochee now to look at the 53 acres from Peachtree Creek in the center of Atlanta running south past Serenbe to Chattahoochee Bend State Park. And that then led to looking at the river corridor as a whole. We had established we wanted to look at a mile on each side of the river because the river keepers have done a good job in Atlanta of protecting the river and really improving the water quality in the river. But no one who was looking at the valley on each side of the river. And if you look at North Atlanta, all the development has happened. We had that opportunity, if we could move forward with a master vision, to change that for the Southern Corridor. Mm-hmm. That has now evolved into the Riverlands Project, taken on by Trust for Public Land and the Atlanta Regional Commission, looking at the 100 miles. And that report has now just been published in the last couple months with a master plan. And if you look north, it's basically to connect the green spaces and where are the opportunities for really parks. But this Southern Corridor is to reimagine, working with the counties and the cities on reimagining how we can save a majority of the land for agriculture or recreation and yet put all the density in. And this will be a 100-mile recreational corridor running through the center of one of the largest cities.
Wow, unbelievable.
With agriculture is part of that component in the southern, and villages along the river to where you interrupt it in a few places, but not all. So I think in every city there are these opportunities, and all these things come together, you know, stormwater management, which is the tributaries coming in. And that's finally changing. You know, we had to break the law 20 years ago to do the right thing. And now you see like the big concrete ditch in LA is being changed to a bioretention park. You see what happened to the park at Old Fourth Ward in Atlanta. There's just great examples. And this makes environmental sense, economic sense, quality of life sense. It's just such common sense.
I love it. I find such inspiration every time I talk to you, Steve. There's just the way that you're, one, just your like passion and commitment, your breadth of knowledge and network in these areas. And I think so many people, you know, see you as the Serenbe guy. But I think the reality is like, you know, you're thinking so much bigger. You're working with communities and developers and cities all over. And I think, you know, Serenbe is just such a great testament to your own personal journey and putting these principles into practice. But I think the what's so powerful about it too is just the need, the macro scale of which we're talking about, you know, with Chattahoochee Hill Country, what you just explained with the river, you know, once you start looking at these ecosystems, the context takes you out and out and out. And I think one of the things I've been most excited about in my work and along these lines is working with some of these counties. I think we both had a little bit of involvement with the Douglas County in Nevada. We came in and helped them look at, you know, developing an agri-hood strategy for the county, and then started working with some of the larger landowners doing big TDR projects and putting some, you know, starting to move some of these kinds of ideas into action. So I think when you see it happening at this county kind of larger regional scale, instead of kind of these one-off projects, you can really start to see how the impact can be generational and such a huge impact on the ecosystem and on the health of, you know, communities. And that starts to really make a big difference. I think one of my big takeaways in our talk today is it's powerful to think that you were like, you know, you could do one project, but if it's one project that becomes the accelerator of destructive development, what's the point? But if you can zoom out and look at the macro context and solve some of the problems at a big scale, then it makes sense for you to come in and be a part of that bigger solution and start to put those building blocks in place. And I think that's, you know, for me, as somebody who works on a lot of projects, I think I'm always wondering, you know, where should I be putting my energy and time to have the biggest impact? You know, it really kind of reinforces this larger scale approach and how important that is to make influence policy. And part of the goal of this podcast, this whole season, is really to do exactly what we're doing and shine a light on some of these different ideas, you know, where the lessons learned and where the successes are, so that other people can do what you've done and make a difference in their communities. So I have one kind of challenging question, I guess you could call it, that I'm curious to talk to you about before we wrap up too, is, you know, look, I'm out here right now, you know, with three young kids. I'm where you were 20 years ago, 25 years ago, whatever it was, when you bought the little farm out in the country, right? I want my kids at 3, 7, and 8 to have that lifestyle, right? I want them to be in nature. I want them to be connected. And it's really hard to find communities, one, that are affordable, right? Everybody wants to go to these, you know, the hot places. There's only one Serenbe. There's only a handful of even relatively close to Serenbe type communities. And they're not that accessible for a lot of, even somebody that's, you know, I consider myself to be pretty successful in my work, but, you know, I'm not, I can't go buy a $1 million home right now. And so I'm just curious from your perspective too, like how do we do this work? How do we create these kinds of amazing communities and still have them be accessible to people who maybe can't afford, you know, to pay 40% premium or 20% premiums, or can't even afford, you know, a market rate place?
Well, it's a good question, Darren. And I think what people have to do is broaden their outlook. Now, right now, today, you can come buy property. I already said Serenbe is a 50% premium to my neighborhood. That means you can buy property a mile from Serenbe, and the little town of Palmetto that's the most affordable in Metro Atlanta. So yeah, you might not be able to live in Serenby. It's just like you can't always live in the best street in a town, but you can still live in the town.
Right. And you're not a gated community. So people can come and go to the shops and the restaurant and the farm.
Well, yeah. So if you're a mile away, you can bicycle in. We have people doing that. We have people taking this. And so you look at rural America, there are great towns. There's great structures that's very affordable. So it's rolling up your sleeve and deciding where you and people like you listening to want to be part of changing that, not go into places where it's already changed. And I think as we have more people looking at that, those opportunities is in most rural towns. They're great towns with great bones, with depressed prices, because the agrarian movement, the educational movement, we have so honored only people with a college degree that we've forgotten to bring in the farmers and the plumbers and some of the practical people. And so we've celebrated, and there's a sense for the last 30 years in rural America that your path to success is a college degree. And then these young people get college degrees and there's no jobs back home. And so we have stripped our small towns across America. And I think this movement, what's with the pandemic, changing agriculture, people relooking at quality of life, people can find very affordable housing all over America near these little rural towns, close into the bigger hubs that is going to be the market for the food.
Interesting. Do you see some of these types of, agri-hood type communities being able to be successful with a more mixed income offering?
Well, absolutely. We did what we did, and I'd love to show, elsewhere, but there was a real reason. We have so much affordable housing. And for your public policy people listening to understand the economics, this is with understand the value. The policy people, bankers, somehow they understood the value of a golf course. And it had nothing to do with golf course. It was how the land was being, was open and available somehow. There's much greater value in many more ways to the farms and agriculture. And so this 40,000 acres is a good example. This is all affordable housing. This is why we could rezone 40,000 acres, because no one was thinking about it, even though it's right here on the edge of the city. So now at Serenby, we have disturbed about 100 acres of literally disturbed. I mean, for our streets and our houses and where it's disturbed. Now, that doesn't mean the farm that you look at or the stables. It's things that are still under agricultural use, even though they're right integrated with the community. But what's actually used for housing and the streets and everything to support the housing, which is the tax base. So the 100 acres that's developed in our housing is 50% of the tax base for a 40,000 acre city that has a full-time paid police department, fire department, public works department.
Wow.
And so this is why, it's real common for people to talk about affordable housing. But through small town America, what's happened is the executive housing has disappeared, and now they're strapped from a tax basis because it's primarily affordable housing. And we need to talk more about that. We need more people like you, people who have decided to get out of the big cities for pandemic, and now, quality of life's pretty good where mom and dad used to live or these things. Let's reclaim these small towns across America and bring in that higher tax. Let's fix up those old houses. Let's bring that tax base back to a more balanced economy. And by bringing the farms in, you look at what Will Harris has done to Early County. He's done the same thing to that county that Serenby's done to this rural 40,000 acres. It's changed the economics of it.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting perspective.
Lots of good examples.
Yeah. So we'll finish up here. This has been really fun. I love this conversation. I could talk to you for hours about this stuff, but I hope maybe we'll get a chance to dig back in later, because you have so much more to share. But maybe just to wrap up this session, tell the audience a little bit of like where you're headed next. I mean, with Serenbe and your work with Nigrin Placemaking. I mean, what are some of the big, I mean, you've talked a lot about some of the big exciting things that you're involved in. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you feel like would be, that you want to share that we didn't get into, whether it was, you know, exciting things happening at Serenbe or things that you see in the near future?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's so much to be done, but, you know, right here at Serenbe, you know, two of the big things we're still tackling, and that's how are seniors going to be living? So it's the bookends of our society, you know, our youth and our seniors. We have tended to put them in compounds, we think for their own good. And in reality, it's a prison, and it stripped the vitality of our children. Richard Louv's work, Last Child in the Woods, really brought that to focus and on how that's affecting really the mental development of our kids. And by the way, the executive director for Children Nature Network just moved to Serenbe from Minneapolis, Minnesota. So wow. We're really getting the leadership from all this kind of things here. And we're talking with some really global leaders, not just in America, on what senior housing is going to look like for the future. And it's going to be radically different. And just by the people we're talking to, I believe we're going to be able to announce within the next 12 months a radical approach to senior housing.
Amazing.
That, along with education, our Acton Academy here is booming. There's going to be a new campus for them. Our charter school is with 500 kids. We've changed the health of those kids, and they're coming from a lot of the lower income families in the greater area. And so education and senior housing are the two things that we are really going to be doing some incredible things with to add to the agriculture and the art that are already models.
Beautiful. I love it. And I've just seen the incredible value of agriculture, farming, and gardening as a bridge between those two worlds where seniors love it. They have a lot of time for it. It's super, you know, healing and nurturing to be in the garden, the community, the socialization, being outdoors, you know, having that hands in the soil, eating healthy food. And you see the same thing for kids. And then when you create opportunities for kids and seniors to play together. I mean, I just watched my dad building a sauna, you know, with my son, and seeing my mom do jewelry and gardening with my girls. That's what it's about. You know, it's so enriching.
All of this is interconnected, and we have been in silo attitudes for the last 50 years. And so this is why everybody tried putting Serenbe in a silo. You know, are we new urbanists? Yeah. Are we, you know, agrarian? Are we, you know, environmental? Yeah, we're all these things. But we're none of those singularly. And so that's why we talk about the biophilic development. And so we're really leading that approach because that's all living systems. It's all interconnected. And what you just talked about is that very thing. The environment, our food systems, human health, education, all interconnects.
Love it. That's what this is all about. I'm so excited that we had a chance to dig in like this, Steve. I really do. This is great.
So good chatting with you. And, you know, we always appreciate that you being a part of those early days when too many people thought we were crazy. But you joined me in the dreams, and now we've made all that dream a reality.
But, you know, the irony of that, too, is, you know, when I first got into farming and my parents thought I was nuts, and then to see me back home as part of a project that was so, you know, well respected and so at the forefront, not only was it great just for my career and for like the credibility, you know, and I want to share one last thing with you, because I don't know if I ever shared this with you, Steve, but one of the things that really inspired me to get involved with you at Serenbe was when I had my farm in Wisconsin. You know, I went 2 hours away from Madison, where I was living in at college, to buy a farm that I could afford. It was $1,010 an acre, about 173 acres, cashed in my Coca-Cola shares I got for my bar mitzvah. And, you know, and one of the big ahas for me about 3 years into running the farm was I thought, you know, why did I have to go so far away from my community to be able to do this? And I'm driving 2 hours to the farmer's market and my customers weren't coming to the farm, but maybe once a year. And I started thinking to myself, this is just the wrong model. It's not about bringing food to the people. We have to figure out how to bring the farm to the people. And I started, you know, and that was when I started looking at actually selling some of my land to some of the my CSA members to create a community. And then I started looking and I went into Madison and started a farm in town because I thought I need to put a farm where the people are. And I had my little restaurant business. And so, you know, then I said, you know what, I'm going to go back to school for landscape architecture and figure out how to design these communities. And, you know, and it led me to you and to Serenbe. And that was my, I joke, I never finished college, but I feel like Serenbe was like my thesis because it was proving the theory that when you do put a farm in the middle of a community, not only is it great for the farmer, it's great for the community. And it's just the right, it, to me, it was like, oh my God, here's how we can scale community agriculture that's going to provide a quality of life for the farmer and a quality of life for the residents of all ages, for the community and for the broader community around it. You know, when you tie into the regional agricultural community and, you know, do a lot of the partnerships and relationships that you've done there with UGA and Rodale and all these amazing collaborations that come with that. You know, it was the proving ground for me to see the value and the importance of this. And that was really when I set off on a mission to like, go help seed more of these kinds of projects and really help figure out the farming piece in particular. And I think one thing you said here really also resonated with me, which is, you know, I've realized after doing this for a lot of other developers, I haven't stumbled on another Steve Nygren since I left there in the early 2000s. But, you know, I've worked with a lot of great clients and great projects, but I still feel like there's something missing in a way that, you know, you've spoken to quite a bit on the scale, the approach, this more biophilic approach really resonates with me and addressing a lot of these systemic issues in our society around hunger and food insecurity and around housing and around health, which are all so interconnected. And so I'm really inspired, you know, from our conversation and from our long relationship and to, you know, dig even deeper now coming out of COVID and seeing a lot of these issues come to light more than ever, that we really dig in deeper and figure out how to bring this message that you're sharing and these examples into the world. So I look forward to doing that more with you. And this was an awesome opportunity to just reconnect and recalibrate and get re-inspired.
Well, I enjoyed the conversation. And now in your travels, stop by Serenbe so we can give you and the family a hug.
Join the Citizen Farmers community. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook. For more information, check out today's show notes. This podcast is co-produced by Ben Bernstein. Our audio editor is Sarah Milligan. Thanks for listening to Season 2 of the Citizen Farmers Podcast, where we are reimagining community to create a healthier, more connected world. Do you care about the health of people and the planet? Connect with the Citizen Farmers movement to grow healthy food, build your community, and give back to the earth through actions big or small. Follow us on Instagram or sign up for our newsletter at citizenfarmers.org. To learn more about our work at FarmerD, designing and building vibrant farm-based communities, visit us at farmerd.com. Thanks for listening.